Let's go ahead and open up to Genesis chapter number 28. And verse number 10 is where we pick up the story about Jacob leaving his home territory and heading off to the territory of his mom's family, the territory from which his grandfather originally came, Abraham. And there he's supposed to get married. Now, he's about 77, which because of his long life is roughly equivalent with being in his second half of his 30s for us. So he has delayed getting married a little bit longer than would be normal for his culture, but he is not decrepit. He is still a very vibrant man. So he's leaving because mom in particular is worried that Big Brother will kill him the moment that Yitzhak is dead because of the trickery that was used in order to get the birthright spoken by dad over Jacob. So Genesis chapter 28, Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And that is a good long distance. It should take several weeks if he takes his time. So he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. And this seems to be like on the first or second night of his trip. I'm guessing probably closer to the second night. He took one of the stones of the place and he put it under his head and he lay down in that place to sleep. The impression that we get when we read the full story here is that Yitzhak, his dad, effectively sends him on this trip with a minimal amount of possessions. Effectively, the clothes on his back and the staff in his hand and maybe a few provisions. And that should not actually surprise us too much because even though the story doesn't really talk about it, we can understand why Yitzhak would be very upset with Jacob for tricking him into giving him the blessing of the family, the blessing of Abraham. He pretended to be his brother. He disguised his body. He disguised his voice. He lied outright when asked if he was in fact Esau. And so Jacob is going to be bearing a penalty as he leaves. And so that is, he is traveling all on his own, no servants, even though his family is very well to do. Not even an animal, apparently. So he doesn't even seem to have a tent, doesn't seem at this point. So he lays down all alone. The only thing he's using for a pillow is a stone. And then God gives him a dream. And this is where Jacob has apparently his first supernatural encounter with the God whom his family worships. Verse 12, he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth. And I know I am of the tendency, when I hear ladder, I think about two uprights with the slats in between them, made of aluminum or wood. And that's probably not the image you should have in mind here. I think instead you should have some sort of stairway, some sort of step-sided pyramid, something of that nature that gives you this going up and going down place in your mind. So he dreamed, and behold, there was this ladder or this stairway that was set up on the earth, and the top of it reached into heaven. So it's this connection between heaven and earth. behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Now, I am of the opinion, and that's all it's worth for you, okay, is that this is actually him being able to see what goes on in the spirit world all the time. That this is a place in this location that is an access point, a physical access point between the supernatural world and the physical world of earth. And that the angels, whom Hebrews chapter 1 verse 14 says, are sent to see to the needs of those who will inherit salvation, that these messengers of God, these servants of God, are constantly passing back and forth between the heavenly throne room of God and the earthly area where they do whatever it is that God assigns them to do. And so he's getting a glimpse. The curtain has been drawn back momentarily for him to see what's going on all the time. Verse 13, behold, he who is stood above it and said. So we've got a bit of a throne vision here, if you will. There are several other very clear-cut throne visions where you have God being said to be seated upon a throne, the angels are in attendance, and things are happening. Well, here we've got the access ramp or the access case, and God is up there at the top, presumably telling the angels to go and do stuff or getting information from them as they return. And now he addresses Jacob, who is seeing him in this position of authority and sovereignty. I am he who is. Now, I repeatedly remind you that he who is the literal translation of the divine name, and that's how I'm trying to communicate that this time through our study of the entire Bible. But the divine name, Yahweh, did not come into existence until many hundreds of years after this story happened. So Moses, who is writing this story down, is pretty consistent in inserting the divine name that the Israelites, fresh out of Egypt, are getting used to, meaning the Creator God, the God who got them out of Egypt. So this is Moses' way of saying, the God that appeared to Jacob is the same God that got us out of Egypt. The name that would have been prevalent back at this time would likely have been El Shaddai, or El Elyon. So either God who is your God, if God's saying it, or God who is above all those that claim to be God. So I am the one true God. That's effectively what he was saying here to Jacob. The God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Yitzhak. So Abraham is the first one that embraces this faith of the one true God. Yitzhak is raised in that faith. He is born the child of the promise. And now God wants to be Jacob's personal God as well. And this is important to understanding Jacob. Abram accepted God as his God of his own free will choice. Abraham shared that faith with his son Yitzhak, and it is clear that Yitzhak adopted it as his own because we see him building an altar and calling upon that name of the God of Abraham and also his God. But up to this point, we have not yet seen Yaakov, Jacob, the heel grabber, make his choice to have this same family God as his God. So God is trying to introduce himself and encourage Jacob to follow in the footsteps of Abraham and Yitzhak and trust him. Now, he reminds him that the blessing of this family line is resting upon him right now. Because here's one of the promises from that blessing. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. So the promised land, the land of Canaan, the intention is God will give it to Yaakov. Verse 14, your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, which is just metaphorical for too many to number. You shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. So there's going to be a lot of you, and you'll have to spread out everywhere through this promised land. And your offspring shall, all the families of the earth be blessed. In you and your offspring, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. In my estimation, that is the most important part of the Abrahamic covenant. Because in his Galatians letter, chapter number 3, Paul makes a huge point out of the fact that this word offspring or seed is a collective singular. It can mean the multitude of your offspring, but it also can be fine-tuned down to one specific member of that group. And in the case of Galatians chapter 3, Paul says that offspring, that seed, is Jesus. So this is the messianic portion of the Abrahamic covenant. That in Jacob's line, the Israeli line, the Messiah is going to come through that and out of that family to be the Savior, not just of that family, but of anyone that is of the faith of Abraham, that is, who believes in God, trusts God, and has it accounted to him as righteousness. So Jacob is told, here's the covenant promise. I want you to embrace it as your own. Verse 15, behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So God's promise to Jacob is, I will fulfill my covenant commitment. And that means increasing you in your number, bringing you into this land as your land and the land of your offspring, and then I will bring the Messiah through that line to bless everybody that will name the name. So having received that message, verse 16, Jacob then awoke from his sleep, so it was a dream vision, and said, surely he who is in this place, and I didn't know it. So he thought that this was just some random spot on the road between Beersheba and Haran on this ancient ridgeline highway that traveled through central Canaan up to the road that would take you into Mesopotamia to that tributary on the Euphrates River where Haran is located. But now he realizes this is a special place. This is a place where God meets me. And he was afraid. I mean, why wouldn't you be? I mean, that's a pretty scary thing. How awesome is this place, he said. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So he understood this is one of those access points into the supernatural realm. Because he saw the angels going back and forth to the Creator God. And so he says, this is Beth El. This is the house of God, and this is the front door. So that's his reaction to it. And so he does something that will then become important farther down the line in the history of his people. Verse 18, so early in the morning, Yaakov took the stone that he had put under his head. So he takes this probably smooth-edged stone. Must not have been huge. It must have been just big enough so he could use it as a convenient pillow. And he set it up for a pillar. Now, when we think of pillars, often we think of long, tall pillars. But the word has more of the sense of a marker. So he may have built a little pile of stones and then took his little pillow stone and put it right up on top of the others, maybe building a little stone cairn. And then he poured oil on the top of it. Now, he would have oil on his body, on his possession, because you use it for cooking, you use it for lighting, you use it for personal hygiene every day. You even use it for emergency medication application to keep a wound supple. So olive oil is a common product that you carry with you. But you can also use it to anoint something symbolically, to show that it is special. And so that's exactly what he does here, is he builds this little stone cairn with his little pillow on the top of it. He pours the oil over the top of it, and he called the name of that place Beth El, which Beth means house, El means God. But the name of the city was Luz at the first. So he was not in the city. He was on the outskirts of the city. And so he gives the site that he camped this brand new name. And the Israelis will, when they go into the promised land, conquer Beth El, which will be still known as Luz at that time. But once they destroy the original city, Luz, they will always call it by the Jacob name, Bethel, which is just a few miles north of Jerusalem on this main highway that travels the spine of the land. Verse 20, then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me, which he said he would be, and will keep me in this way that I go, which he said he would do, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, which of course he's going to need if he survives this experience. You have to have your daily bread, and you have to have something to keep you from freezing to death or being burnt to a crisp in the sun. So he goes through this list of, effectively, if God takes care of me like he said he would. Verse 21, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, which God also promised, then he who is shall be my God. So he makes the promise that if God follows through with his promises, then this is what I promise. He will be my personal God. He will be El Shaddai, the God of my chest, the God of my bosom. And this stone, which I have set up for a pillar, shall be God's house. So he actually makes a promise to make a shrine at this specific place when he comes back, and he will keep that promise. Now, when we talk about God's house, often we think of a very formal temple, and Jacob will not make a formal temple here. He will make a shrine, a worship site, but not a formal temple. However, many, many years later, there will be a formal temple built at this site, but unfortunately, it is where they will put a golden calf to represent the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in direct violation of the covenant. And so that is a most unfortunate way that what Jacob says here eventually is, here's some air quotes, fulfilled, shall we say, by Jacob's later family members, thinking they're doing a good thing when in fact they were doing a bad thing. One last thing that he makes as part of his vow, part of his promise. And of all that you give me, I shall give a full tenth to you. And this is what we commonly refer to as a tithe. 10% of your annual income given into the hands of God's service. That is, you give them to probably like a priest or to somebody working on behalf of God at some sort of site. So this is where he makes the vow that he personally will pay a tenth every year to the work of God. And the tithe may have existed long before this, because we know that when Abraham came back from a successful military operation, that he gave one-tenth of the spoil to Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High at Salem, or Jerusalem, to be used in God's work there. And so it seems that the 10% is not some sort of thing that just Abraham came up with even, but rather it must have been a common practice. And I think we see that God takes Jacob's vow and incorporates it into the Israeli nation's way of functioning, where they give one-tenth. Every last one of them are expected to give one-tenth of their income into the temple, into the tabernacle first, to be used for God's service. Now, part of that 10% is going to be used to upkeep a location of worship. Another part of it is going to be used to support those in full-time and part-time service to that work. And then a portion of that tithe will also be used to be kept on hand in case people fall on hard times and need assistance, need support. And guess what? That is exactly the same reason churches today still need to collect money. We need to have money available to keep a place of worship and study and fellowship open. We need to be able to pay those of us that are in full-time and part-time service to that effort. And we also need to have ready available cash, ready available financial support for those in our number that fall on tough times and need a little bridge assistance. And so I believe that even though the New Testament does not demand that Christians pay a tithe, that it is still to be expected as proper financial practice. It gives us a chance to say thank you to God for what he's done, just like what we see here for Jacob. But it also pragmatically keeps the work moving forward. So my friends, if you are not in the habit of giving a tithe of your income to the work of God, particularly at the place where you worship and fellowship and serve, then you need to keep giving and increasing your giving until you reach that level, because it is most certainly needed. In fact, I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen if you and others don't provide that support. First, the church will not have the ability to help people that are falling on hard times, so they'll scale back on that. Secondly, they won't have the money available to have full-time workers, let alone part-time workers, so they'll start scaling back on that. And then, finally, once they can't scale back anymore because they've probably got a volunteer working in the ministry and they're paying them hardly anything, if they're still having financial difficulties, they'll close the facility. And that is not helpful to the mission. So again, I want to very strongly encourage you, wherever you call your church home, pay a tithe to the Lord's work there. And if you're not currently up to the 10%, work your way up to it. I promise you, you will not be able to outgive God. And you will realize some very significant blessings from Him. Not because He has to bless you because you're paying a tithe. I think that's ridiculous that some of these so-called Bible teachers try to use that as leverage to get you to pay. I think it is because you have adjusted your attitude and care about such things that God's blessing reciprocates back on you to basically make sure you understand that you are in right standing with Him. All right, chapter 29 is where we go to next, and so we're just barely going to get started in this before we run out of time today. So Jacob went on his journey, and he came to the land of the people of the east. That's the name for Mesopotamia, or at least it's one of the names applied to Mesopotamia. And he looked, and he saw a well in the field. So he's arrived at Haran. He knows that his family lives here, relatives that he's never met. And so he comes to this well, and behold, there's three flocks of sheep lying beside it. For out of that well the flocks were watered, and the stone on the well's mouth was large. This is a security device to keep things and people from falling down into this well whenever people aren't around actively using it. And so when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and then they'd put the stone back in place over the mouth of the well. So he comes to this watering place, and the watering well is locked up. It's got this massive stone rolled in place, and people are waiting around for it to get unlocked once everybody has arrived. And so the next part of the story tells us just how vibrant a physical specimen Jacob is. And I look forward to talking to you about that tomorrow.